For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Today's episode is a conversation with Mike Cation, voice of the USTA Pro Circuit. Does a great podcast with Noah Rubin called Behind the Racket, and you can find him at Mike C. Tennis on all social medias known to man, including Twitch and YouTube, where he's doing pregame shows before a lot of the Challenger events, and really one of the best and favorite members of tennis media for not just myself, but I think so many tennis fans. We are going to get into Cam Norrie in a ton of depth and really awesome insights on Cam Norrie, in my opinion, out of this discussion. Taylor Fritz, Nicholas Basilashvili, the crowds at Indian Wells, why so many seeds lost, and some of the issues or improvements that might be possible when it comes to the ATP Challenger Tour. First, I do want to get in a little bit more depth solo here on the carnage and the fact that we did have a Masters 1000 unlike any I can remember in recent times, in the respect that there were no top 25 seeds in the semifinals. And you had a final in Nicholas Basilashvili and Cam Norrie that did feel more shocking and surprising than any final you can remember, really, since Filip Krajinovic and Jack Sock in Paris 2017. And I think there were a couple of things at play here. Yes, Mike and I talk about this as well. And Mike proposes the court conditions. So I'll skip that part. And we'll get to that in the interview. But the first thing is something I've talked about a lot. Weird stuff happens after the U.S. Open. Always has, always will. Motivation is all over the map. There are players, especially the top guys, who have played, generally speaking, despite less tournaments, potentially more matches. They are more financially comfortable. They may have different levels of motivation at this time of year. And some of them, such as Alexander Zverev, have been very, very open about hating how long this season is. The second part is injuries, and I think players have more than anything at this time of year, there are a lot of players who aren't healthy. And that can dictate a lot. Mostly the motivation. Things are weird after the U.S. Open. But then you go through the list. Daniil Medvedev. I got to bring up the court conditions with Medvedev. This was as slow as a clay court, slower than some clay courts. And we've gone over why that is not good for Daniil Medvedev and his offensive output. It's hard for him. Gritty court, not good for him. Bad matchup in Dimitrov. Slices the backhand really fast, elite speed. Talked about it in the post-match video. Bad matchup, bad conditions. Medvedev goes out. Was the way it happened shocking? Yes, it was. But you zoom out and you get it. Tsitsipas, I still think he came in with an illness. I don't think he was right. He was coughing. after his post-match interviews and just didn't sound good. And he looked a little weaker and he looked a little slower. All weak to me. Basilashvili, also not a great matchup. Tsitsipas's pace absorption, not great. Not the best. He's not Medvedev. He's not Zverev. He's not Djokovic. He's not that kind of player. He's a little bit different. He can be susceptible to the heavier hitters. And they've always played close, him and Basilashvili. Bad matchup, came in ill. Zverev, look, one in every 20 matches, you're going to have a Zverev double fault match. You're just going to have it. So Zverev plays a really good match against Taylor Fritz, a really, really good match, and then loses his second serve and loses the match. It's just going to happen. One in every 20 matches is going to happen with him at the moment. That's where we're at with him. And he runs into a hot player in Taylor Fritz as well. But deep into the tournament, you got to expect that. So this was a Zverev double fault match. Okay. Andrei Rublev, I don't love him when the conditions are this slow. I think that hurts him a lot. I think he needs to play in conditions where he can finish with his first serve plus one. Otherwise, he can get worn down. And he gets a guy in Tommy Paul, who I had as a dark horse, was the only unseeded player to make the round of 16. So since my predictions were so horrific in every other respect, I'm going to take credit for that. 7-5 in the third. Tommy Paul in the best, most ideal conditions possible in a tournament that is very close to his heart. And Paul plays a great match. Berrettini hasn't been that good since Wimbledon. Hasn't looked right to me. I think he's been too mistake prone. I don't think he's playing as clean as he did prior to Wimbledon and at Wimbledon. And I just don't think he's been the same player. So Berrettini loses to Taylor Fritz, who is playing awesome tennis, top 20 level. And then lastly, Casper Ruud. Ruud has a bit of an arm injury and just didn't have the weight of shot, didn't have the heaviness on the forehand, and then plays the good version of Diego Schwartzman. The good version of Diego Schwartzman has been pretty good in 2021. And then there's the version of Diego Schwartzman this year that doesn't look like a top 100 player. And I have no hypothesis. I have no idea why that is. The Diego Schwartzman season has confounded me. I can't get a read on him whatsoever. But, you know, I think Casper Ruud, I do chalk that up a little bit too. I think there was an injury there. So you go down the list. Are there surprising results in there? Yeah, there are some head scratchers. Was anything completely crazy given the time of the year and all things considered? I don't think any in isolation are that crazy. The fact that it all happened, the fact that none of them got through, none of them were able to put the pieces together and make it to the final four. Yeah, that's surprising. It's definitely surprising. But what I hate are the dystopian post-Big Three era takes. This is what we're going to get now that the Big Three are gone and it stinks. I can't stand that because, first of all, we just had a fantastic U.S. Open. Fantastic. And I know Djokovic was a part of that, but outside of him, it was fantastic. So can we stop it with that? After the U.S. Open, strange things happened. The conditions were weird, which is the main thing that Mike and I talk about. And there were some injuries, some illnesses, some bad matchups. I mean, this kind of made sense. And again, really happy for Cam Nouri. And I'm going to get into that with Mike Cation. So without further ado, here it is.
We're joined for the first time by Mike Cation, the longtime and preeminent voice of the USTA Pro Circuit, among many other things. He is truly one of the most important voices in tennis media. Fans adore him for good reason. Everybody except Sophie Amiak maybe is a big fan of his. And I'm very excited to have you on Monday Match Analysis for the first time.
Very kind words. Thanks, Gil. I appreciate it.
So you were at Indian Wells.
Yeah.
Let's get into the champion on the men's side right off the bat, Cam Nouri. And one of the unique things about talking to you about any of these guys is you were probably watching them before we were.
Yeah. we were doing Bank of the West Radio, which is the on-site radio in Indian Wells. And immediately afterwards, I will be perfectly blunt. I was in tears. I was tearing up because 5 years ago to the week, I watched Cam Norrie play Tommy Paul in Stockton or Fairfield, one of the two challengers. And then 5 years later, I'm watching them battle at a Masters Series 1000, battling for a spot in the quarterfinals. And on top of it, you know, actually during the trip, one of those, you know, I think it was Instagram memories or something along those lines popped up 4 years ago. So 1 year later, Cam had won back-to-back challengers and needed a ride to Fairfield because he was going to pull out because of injury and he didn't have a rental car. So it was me, Cam Norrie, and his coach, Facundo Lugones. The three of us packed into a very tiny rental car of mine and we drove together. And so, yeah, I've known Cam for 5-6 years. And what strikes me is that he hasn't changed as a human being. He is a very kind and humble young man. What I remember about that car ride was it, none of it was about him or his tennis or anything like that. He was peppering me with questions for the entire hour and a half, he and Facundo. They were asking me about how I got involved in tennis, just some of my favorite memories of broadcasting. And it's the same thing. I interviewed him a couple times during this championship and he asked me how my daughter was. And he asked how things were going at Illinois, knowing that I used to be in Champaign, Illinois. And that's just who he is as a person. And so it's one of those moments, Gil, where I'm very enthused to see how he has improved on the tennis court. And obviously what he's doing right now is phenomenal. But what is really striking for me is that he has not changed as a person, despite all of that success. He's still the same Cam Norrie, still has the same girlfriend. His parents are amazing people. He's just a good human being. And to see that incredible success happened to a person like that is truly rewarding. And yeah, I've gotten to see some of these guys grow up as people. And he's just a great person. And I felt very lucky to be able to watch him succeed at that level.
Well, that's obviously great to hear. And I knew Facundo for a little bit. He coached at my academy probably before he began coaching camp. So way back. Yeah. He probably remembers me as a player that had limited potential. And I hope it
happens when we're a little bit on the diminutive side, Gil. Yes,
it does. It does. Okay. As a player, what did you see in Cam as a player when you were calling his matches on the challenger circuit?
I can say that it was more than anything, his phenomenal level of competition and intelligence. The backhand that he has now was not what he had then. It was fine. It was functional. It was in that kind of blunt backhand, but it wasn't that full follow through. So what he's been able to do and how what I think has made him most potent is just the ability for that backhand now to be a weapon. It is really difficult to handle. And I apologize. I'm going to have a cat that just hops in here. There she is. Momentarily.
We want that. That's,
I mean, yeah, yeah. That's what you came to YouTube for, is to watch me play with my cats. But basically what he's been able to do with that backhand and make it so potent and so damaging and so hard to handle, I think that's the biggest level of improvement. On top of it, yeah, I mean, he needed to get physically stronger. And I think that has been a very big thing. And I've told this story before, that basically he had one tournament. He actually won the title in Binghamton, New York, where he had the yips with his toss. He would basically just have these, he couldn't find his toss. Like it was the weirdest thing. You had players who were screaming about it, like asking for the supervisor, because Cam's just sitting there like trying to throw up his toss and can't find where he's supposed to hit his serve. And he's just like, and so it'd be 4, 5, 6 tosses at a time. I mean, it was literally 40 or 50 per set. It was crazy. but I think that's the thing, is he just continued to work And I saw, you know, Matthew Willis, of course, on Twitter, and he made that point about how too many people, and myself probably included, just say, you know, this shows what hard work can do. And you know, that's kind of like a false narrative, because obviously there is an extreme level of talent. I think it took Cam a little bit more time to reach that talent. I think his level of intelligence is off the charts good.
Yeah.
And so he and Facundo, and he also works with the folks in the LTA. He also works still very closely with Devin Bowen, who's the assistant coach at TCU. And they have all put together a plan, knowing in 3 or 4 years what he could be. And so I think it's maybe one of those situations, Gil, where you think about how to achieve a long-term goal, and Cam really set to that and really locked in on it. And that's something I think we kind of lose track on. Too many players maybe will go for quick success and trying to do too much too quickly. Whereas Cam was able to look at it big picture with a good group around him to get to this point where at this stage of his career, 2020 and then 2021, he is what everybody wanted him to be 4 or 5 years ago.
Most sexual assaults go unreported. At Sarnco, we believe, empower, and advocate for all survivors. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted and needs support, call 844-644-6435. 844-644-6435. At Sarnco, we're here for you.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What I'd say on the topic of hard work, what I've gathered is everyone on the tour is pretty much willing to hit for hours every day, to work on technique, to spend time on the court. But when it comes to diet, when it comes to fitness, there are levels to it. And one thing that stood out about Cam, you know, he went deep in San Diego the week before Indian Wells. Then he played three setter. I went into the match against Diego Schwartzman wondering how fresh he would be. The reality is he doesn't run out of steam. You know, he is as fit as anyone out there. And honestly, I don't think that his play style would work if he was not at that elite level of fitness. That's my read on things.
Yeah. And it's interesting to say that, because if you look at him, you wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
He just looks like an average dude. Quite frankly, there's not like defined muscle tone. I don't know if you saw this, but there was a really interesting article. Facundo Lugones was interviewed, and basically they talked about Cam's heart. And I'm not talking about he's got a lot of heart and can get through these matches, but at Battle of the Brits last year, when they were doing those exhibitions, they had those mechanisms that kind of looks like a sports bra, but helps test heart capability and things. And I apologize, I don't know exactly what they're called, but you've seen Andy Murray wear them in training quite a bit.
Yep.
And basically it's normally, once you hit 180 to 200 beats per minute, if you do that for more than 2 minutes, most people will literally die. Their heart will stop. And that includes a lot of top level athletes. Cam was able to go 8 minutes above 180 beats per minute. So his heart muscle itself, literally, not figuratively, his heart muscle itself operates at a level that 99.999% of humans can't get to, that all of those other humans will literally die. So he has that capability to remain calm, and it allows his body to function when maybe most other people would not function. So yes, he is in good, very good shape. And he has this capability that most of us do not, where he can still maintain that muscle movement and brain movement at a lower level, even though his heart is pumping like ridiculously high. So it's that was a fascinating insight from Facundo that, yeah, Cam has a level of fitness that we just can't attain.
Wow. So he has like a double big heart.
Yes.
He has a big heart in both the figurative sense, yes, and the literal. That's fascinating.
Yes, it is.
It reminds me kind of like Michael Phelps's feet, sort of. And, you know, right. Michael Phelps also probably has a similar thing going on with his heart.
We actually had Sophie Amiak, who you mentioned, a commentator. We were actually having kind of a joking discussion, but she said, well, that's almost cheating. And I said, yeah, I know. I mean, but that's the thing. It's physically gifted. It's not enhanced. It just is. What an incredible blessing for him.
Are we too obsessed with weapons as a tennis society? Do we look at weapons and power and, you know, Cam Nori just won a Masters 1000 tournament. He's 10th in the race. And a lot of people at first glance, and look, weapons are important, don't get me wrong, but they might say Cam is not going to reach the top because the weapons aren't there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately as well. I think weapons can be different things than maybe what we normally think of. I think we, you know, typically will say, you know, Delpo's forehand, Riley Opelka's serve, you know, those types of situations. Even down at the challenger level, I think of Dennis Kudla having that backhand down the line is a huge weapon. Cam has weapons. It's just not what you think of in a traditional sense. And I'm using him obviously as the example to get to your bigger point, but his ability to use that backhand as he does, such a devastating ball to get the second ball on his forehand wing that he can either put away or force an error. It is not in the traditional sense what a weapon is, but it is incredibly potent. It might just cause a lot of forced errors that doesn't have that high winner count, but that is a weapon. So to answer your question specifically, I think maybe we could broaden the definition of what is a weapon.
Totally
agree. This is not one that I can say forehand weapon. It's his ability to hit a combination with starting with that backhand that is a ridiculous weapon. I think there's possibilities of that being the case. Now, I know you were going to get to this eventually here, Gil, but this court and the way that the courts at Indian Wells were playing neutralized a lot of weapons.
Yeah.
So his capability to put together combinations on repeat, which is his weapon, that was enhanced.
As was the ability to hang tough in long rallies, sure, and sure, figure out creative ways to force errors when the winners weren't really going to flow, unless you were Nicolas Basilashvili, in yes, which case the winners might flow anyway.
Along with a lot of unforced errors, but that's beside yes, the point.
Well, okay, let's hit on him real quick. I feel like Basilashvili is who he is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the man is likely not going to change. He's 29 years old. His game is rather intriguing in a lot of ways. There are allegations that have been formally filed in court that should trouble everyone. But in terms of the power, it's insane to watch.
It is.
I just think he's always going to be the guy who might catch fire, slow conditions, ATP 500, could win it any given week, is still going to lose first round a lot. Like, I just don't think that's going anywhere.
I completely agree with you. I will say I interviewed him twice during the week, and he talked a lot about how he has been working with a mental coach and working on being a little bit more consistent with his play. He also told me he didn't think at all about the conditions and how it affected how he plays, which to me was a very interesting, I couldn't actually fathom that, to be perfectly blunt with you, because I found myself, as I'm watching him, thinking, the fact that the ball is checking up, it gives him more time to load up and hit as big as he does. This is ideal for him. I think it was a perfect week, a perfect situation where everything fell into place, and he is going to have some of those weeks. And nobody really, which match was it that I'm looking at my draw here. The Tsitsipas match was Stefanos. The game plan that they had was just, frankly, not ideal. There was no level of aggression from Stefanos. And I don't know if that was game plan related necessarily or execution related, but Stefanos was very defensive through that entire match and allowed Basilashvili to just continue to have time to load up. There was no adjustments that Stefanos made to move forward or work angles a little bit better. He has so many capabilities off of both wings, Tsitsipas does, and just didn't ever use it. So that was the one where I found myself thinking, Tsitsipas should win this 9 times out of 10 with his weapons, his capabilities. And he didn't, for whatever reason, whether it be game plan, whether it be execution, it was not there. He was on his back heel the entire time.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from the match also. I wanted to give Basilashvili credit for pulling off the upset, but my main thing after that match was, wow, that was not a match that Stefanos should have lost. No. I think sometimes maybe the power could have a bit of an intimidation factor. And, you know, from a court position perspective, Tsitsipas was not where he needed to be in order to play his offensive tennis. And I think that's what ended up happening there.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it was interesting to know, because Taylor Fritz actually then in the next round in the semifinals then tried to do it a little bit more effectively. He was returning from the baseline, at least making that attempt, right, to get Basilashvili out of his comfort zone, which I appreciated. But, you know, Basilashvili just executed the big moments a little bit better. Taylor Fritz had more opportunities in that semifinal. I think 7 break chances and wasn't able to convert in a single one. So, you know, then you saw it in the very next round. Fritz had the looks, even though he was getting bullied a little bit, pushed around by the incredible power of Basilashvili, but at least had the opportunities, just wasn't able to execute.
Tsitsipas, one of the many players who were surprised at the top of the men's game, includes Medvedev and Zverev, who not only lost, but lost after holding big leads. People had expectations for Casper Ruud in this tournament. Is there any explanation, large scale, for the carnage we saw? Or to you, would we have to go case by case by case by case? Or was there something going on here?
I think you have to look at the court speed. I mean, listen, the Medvedev situation was, I mean, a set and two breaks for number two player in the world. I don't know what the heck happened there. I really don't. And I watched the damn thing and I still have no idea what was going on there. I think you have to look at the court speed. So many times, even on slower courts, even on clay, the ability to get a few free and easy points. I mean, this was playing slower than a lot of clay courts. I just think you had to work a little bit more than you've had to in other events, other tournaments. And it was on the women's side as well, right? I mean, it just, you had to have the easy, raw power of Basilashvili or the incredible level of consistency of Cam Nori is a great example, right? Like Azarenka on the women's side, her ability to outlast opponents got her through to the final, and top of it, her intelligence, right, of consistently adjusting. So it basically came down to two things for me, just that willingness to stay in for 3 hours or the ability to just go full out. So in terms of just the carnage, yeah, it was a tournament unlike anything I've ever seen. The tennis wasn't always great quality, to be blunt. So I think as a result, you just saw a lot of things that should have come easy that just didn't, because it was flipping hard. It was really hard.
I can subscribe to that. No doubt about that. I think there are some players who still should have thrived. You know, everyone's carrying an injury at this time of year. There are things happening. Motivation, I think, is in different places for players after the U.S. Correct. Open. Many, many things there. Unfortunately, the crowds were not what you'd expect out of a normal Indian Wells. It was obviously in an unconventional spot in the calendar in October. You were on the grounds. I'm sure this was a topic of discussion. What was the read on this?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you can definitely say that, and I understand why. Crowds probably a half on the once we got to the finals weekend, probably half of what it would normally be. I think you can look at a glass half empty or half, you know, half full, right? For me, I think I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. It's in October. Schools are in session. You don't have the spring break situation. Indian Wells is obviously a destination tournament for so many people from around the world. That is wiped out. No kids under the age of 12. So that rules out a lot of families. But I think the travel one is just the big part of it. Nobody's going to be flying from Europe to come to Indian Wells in October when it's so difficult right now. But yeah, it was a topic of conversation. I think most of us were able to appreciate what it was, which is a great opportunity to again come to a place, especially considering it was the tournament where everything got canceled and everything stopped. So to have this event again was a big positive. I think everybody who was there felt safe, was happy. It was actually like a really fun, good atmosphere. Did it maybe have bad optics in terms of the crowd not being perfect? Sure. But it was a lot of fun if you were on the grounds. But I just think it's...
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I think it's asking way too much to believe that it should have been 3/4 attendance or full attendance. It just wasn't going to happen. I think if you appreciated it as it was, I think it was a great atmosphere. The fans that were there had a very good time, the ability to roam the grounds a little bit more free because it wasn't packed. It was a lot of fun to be there is what I can tell you. And yeah, if you wanted 3/4 audience, you weren't going to get it. It just wasn't going to happen. So I think it was perfect for what it was at this stage.
Okay. That's insightful. And, you know, a lot of this is about routine, I think. And we've even seen this in television ratings when all of these, whether it be the NBA playoffs, the NHL playoffs, when these things are moved, they rate lower on television even because people are not, the calendar matters to people. It's part of a routine. So, you know, looking forward to getting it hopefully in the normal calendar spot. I'm sure that's the plan next year.
I think that, you know, we've already got the dates. I read the commercial several times, March 7th through the 20th, 2022. So, but yeah, I think you'll, you know, again, hopefully we get to a point where more specifically people can travel a little bit more freely throughout the states, more from Europe. Just that capability to come out to California in March is phenomenal. And I think it's a routine for a lot of people from around the country to be able to come out there at that time of the year, especially spring break. Hopefully kids will be able to come on site again under the age of 12. I think that's the hope. If we were to have this kind of crowd again in March, I think maybe you'd have a bigger discussion point. But I tend to think, you know, again, all things being as they are looking right now with COVID, I think it'll be a completely different story in March.
Yep, I agree. American tennis, Taylor Fritz, semifinalists. I feel like there's a good competitive mojo happening right now. There's a lot of Americans that are basically iron sharpening iron, whether it be the youngest generation of Brooksby, Korda, Nakashima, or your Taylor Fritzes and Riley Opelkas, who, you know, they would never say this, but I think there's a sense of trying to fend them off and stay the alphas. Are we going to see a Taylor Fritz revenge tour a little bit? Because he was the guy for a fair bit of time. And it wasn't Taylor's going to win majors, but it was, you know, Taylor's going to be the top gun. And Well, look, anyone who was saying that after Memphis and way back when, I mean, it was definitely premature, right?
I'm thinking about when he was 17 and 18 years of age.
Right.
I think that was a realistic discussion that Taylor Fritz is going to win majors. I think that is absolutely real.
Where do you see the trajectory of him now after his career best result?
What he said to me in one of our interviews that we did on site was actually really telling, Gil. He said to me, bringing on Paul Anacone, working with David Ninken, one thing they've started to do is just simplify, make things simple on the court. He says he overthinks, which is absolutely accurate. He is one of those guys who has 30 different things going on in his head. And he said with Matteo Berrettini, it was that after that match that he won 4-3. And he said, I know what the game plan is supposed to be against Matteo Berrettini. In years past, what I would do was try to overthink that and then go to the opposite plan so that he's thinking about that. And then I'm thinking about this. And he said, no, I just wanted to expose the backhand as much as possible. So one hit ball to the forehand and then just expose the backhand. Very simple. And I executed. And frankly, I think that's a massive step for him. I don't know. I don't know if he's ever going to be the Grand Slam champion. I think working with Paul Anacone over the last, whatever it's been, 8-9 months, I do think that they're getting to that point where they're getting and honing in on what he's capable of and how to effectively execute a game plan. I think he's top 10 capable. I'll put it to you that way. And then a Grand Slam, maybe. But, you know, again, until Novak goes away, I don't. Maybe. I mean, there are, you know, two or three people on the men's side right now that I could say, okay, yeah, I could see Medvedev, obviously. I could see Zverev. I think that's, outside of that, I don't know anybody's able to beat Novak right now.
For sure.
But I think I think to your broader point about American tennis on the men's side, the depth is incredible. I don't know what it is today because the rankings just came out yesterday. And frankly, I either traveled or slept. And that's all I've done since I left Indian Wells. But I know it was 13 Americans inside the top 100 when we were in Indian Wells. I mean, that's incredible depth. There's a lot of them. And yes, I think. Frankly, even more than your idea of kind of pushing each other, the fact that they're together at these events now, and it's not just, you know, one American in Moscow and one American in Antwerp. Now they're starting to go together and they're having that little comfort zone where they're able to travel together a little bit and push each other a little bit. That's going to make a big difference. Again, I don't know if any of these guys are, none of them say immediately, yes, 100% Grand Slam winner. But a lot of them have that top 20 capability, and then maybe something happens from there that's really special.
Yep. I think with Taylor, I'm a huge fan of everything he does within his control. I do worry that he's capped at a certain point athletically. You know, he just does not, I don't know that he'll ever get to the point of moving well enough to really be in the elite tier one.
Needs to be on a slower surface, Gil. I think that's, yeah. You're exactly right. I mean, that again, Indian Wells, where he had just that millisecond more time, right? I mean, look what happened. I think that was some of the best movement he had. Agreed. There are still also some things where he can be more efficient with his movement. And I think that's a big key as well. So I think you're right. He's not going to win Wimbledon. I don't think that there's ever a chance of that, or a faster hard court. I think that's going to be a real challenge for him. But I think he can still get incrementally better. Mm-hmm. And some of the slower courts might work well for him in that regard.
I'm going to end on this. Yeah. It's probably a question that could potentially set you off on a 30-minute essay soliloquy.
Listen, I am not Alex Gruskin, okay?
That's a great point. You know, you're going to keep this nice and concise, I bet. If you're a commissioner of the Challenger Tour, you are in charge of those tournaments, that product, looking to maximize the fan experience, improve conditions for the players.
Yeah, this is economics. Gonna be 30 minutes.
I know. Well, are there any, what is pressing to you if you got to be in charge? What were some things that you would try to implement on the challenger level?
Okay. Number one, we need more. The more opportunity, the better. That is a challenging thing. Number two, we need to think long and hard about how we're labeling the Challenger Tour. And maybe we should stop using the Challenger Tour. Maybe we should re-identify how we look at that so that people who are more of a casual fan don't think, oh, this person is a Challenger player, because that does not help in the least. Number three, we do need to work a little bit more on the top-down financing. You saw how big of a deal it was at the US Open when we started talking about how much more money it was for qualifying. That's a big deal just to have, again, incrementally increased finances. We have not changed the finances at the Challenger level in 15 years. Something needs to give there. I don't like the way it's been marketed. Again, I feel like people believe it's a completely different tour when in 2 weeks in Charlottesville, we're going to have, I think, five top 100 players, five main draw Grand Slam players like that are going to be there. And yet we're going to label it as something a lower level. I think that is really, really harmful. I mean,
Is there enough creativity there? It doesn't seem like there are a lot of things in terms of connecting to audiences, connecting to fans, doing things with content that are interesting and maybe, you know, just creativity and trying things and effort. I mean, I look at just some things that certain leagues are doing, and I just think that there's a little bit more thought going into growth. I don't really see that.
That is my exact point with the marketing.
Okay.
There are not enough resources given at the ATP or at the WTA for that matter, in terms of how we market them.
Yep.
It is, again, you've got Josh Mycelis is a dear friend of mine who runs the ATP Challenger Tour Twitter and Instagram, and he does it almost entirely by himself. Meanwhile, he's got five or six tournaments to look at on a given week. And how is any one or even two people, how are they going to put together a successful marketing campaign to make it seem like this is a really attractive product? You just can't do it. With that much going on in so many different locations, you can't get to. It'd be one thing if he had somebody on the ground in every single tournament and could do all sorts of great content. So yes. That is a top down type of a situation. We can talk a lot about the money side of players, but you're absolutely dead on. It is really hard to sell a challenger when again you have one or two people trying to handle 200 tournaments a year. The effective marketing of that, and it's Josh is great. My friend Jacob also does a little bit with Josh, and there's some other great people at the ATP. But yes. They need three or four more people realistically to make that a very successful marketing social media campaign. And that's just one thing. I mean, that's just one component of it, because ultimately, like on the ground, I worked in PR. You are right. I did get half an hour and get a little bit passionate about this. I worked in PR for the Champaign Challenger for 10 years. At the University of Illinois at the time, we had a great product, especially when Craig Tiley was there and we're coming off a national championship. We had Amir Delic and Rajiv Ram. Amir got to 60 in the world. Rajiv, obviously, what he's done now is incredible. And then a couple of years after that, we had Kevin Anderson as well. I mean, we had top, top level players. It was so difficult to sell that tournament to Champaign media. Like, again, small market media, because again, you're competing here in the States. Often you're competing with football, you're competing with basketball, you know, so you're trying to shoehorn in something in a spot, and like, Charlottesville and the same thing in a couple of weeks. They're competing with the start of college basketball, the end of college football. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And we've got a very dedicated tennis audience, as I know you do, with your 8 trillion subscribers on YouTube, because God bless you, you're the one guy doing it here on YouTube. But like, we have a very dedicated audience in some locations, but how we get the casual audience to come to some of these challengers, it's really hard. It's really challenging. And I know there are a lot of people who care passionately about doing it. There's not the greatest communication top down to make sure everything works, but there are a lot of people who care desperately and want to make it successful. I still don't have a great answer for how we connect everybody to make the product perfect.
Yeah. Well said, Mike Cation, USTA Pro Circuit, Behind the Racket podcast, Tennis Channel Podcast Network, Spotify, iTunes, all of that. Twitch, some sort of Twitch, but Mike, I'm not up on this. I don't know what's going on there.
Listen, when the challengers start again, so November 1st, we'll be in Charlottesville. We're going to start doing our pregame shows again. It's on Twitch, twitch.tv/MikeCTennis. It's also on my YouTube channel, which is also MikeCTennis. And basically we do half an hour live beforehand, any questions, give you a preview of the day. And then obviously go to wherever you watch your challengers on the USTA Pro Circuit homepage or on livestream.com.
There you go. All right. You're the best. Hope to see you soon.
Cheers, buddy.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.